The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com, I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the author of The Christmas Box in his last book, Lost December. He's got a brand new book, A Winter Dream. I'd like to welcome back Richard Paul Evans. Richard, welcome back.
It's always good to be here. Thanks, Mark.
You have three books out now since the last time I talked to you, but a brand new one, A Winter Dream. This is a Christmas novel. This book takes place in Colorado, in Denver. Why Denver?
Well, it's the story of Joseph and the Coat of Many Colors, written as if it happened today. So it starts in Denver, but it moves into Chicago. So instead of Egypt, we're in Chicago. So I was just looking at kind of a place that was small enough, kind of provincial enough, that we could move into a bigger city, just like Joseph went through when he was sold off to the Ishmaelites. So that's why. That's no other reason.
Just you like Denver, I guess.
It worked. It just kind of worked, and I try to use different places in the country. I wanted someplace out west because he ends up going to Chicago and New York. And so from someone... Again, if you look at the story of Joseph, he was going from a small place to a very large place. And so I needed to go someplace where he could, you know, have that transition.
You know, I've heard of musicians such as, you know, like the Beatles, which you mention in here. You know, there was a lady in here that didn't even know of the Beatles, which I thought strange. But as the story goes on, you find out why. But they got their ideas, I think, from records of old. Do authors like yourself, I mean, here's a book, a great story, Joseph and His Coat of Many Colors, written like today. Do authors go back in time and look at things and get ideas that way?
Well, ideas come from many, many different places, from real life. And in terms of taking a biblical story, I don't know, maybe it was Oscar Wilde who said that every story already exists in the Bible. I'm not the first author to take a Bible story and retell it. John Steinbeck in East of Eden was writing the story of Cain and Abel. And of course, it extrapolated a whole lot to make that really wonderful epic novel. In this case, I had a year before, last year, wrote Last December, and I took the story of the prodigal son. And the reason I did that was not that I wanted to take a Bible story, because I was nervous about taking a Bible story. The reason I did is because I wanted to write the story of redemption. And so as I meditated on this, I thought, what's the greatest story of redemption ever written? I thought, maybe it's the story of the prodigal son. And that's how that started. Well, I was nervous how it would do in the commercial market. If Bible readers would be offended by that. I just didn't know how, and people who didn't read the Bible might not like the reference to that. And so I really don't know how this will do, but I don't care because it's going to be a really good story. And so I wrote the story, and it did extremely well. It did very well. And what I learned, one reader said, I'm in a bookstore, and the man next to me had 25 copies, these stacks of the book. And she said, well, you have a lot of Christmas gifts. And he says, I'm a pastor, and we're using this for Bible study. And I thought, well, this is interesting. Okay, obviously they don't hate it, and that they're finding it useful to take these wonderful principles in the Bible and to make it accessible to people, to everyone. And so I thought, well, let's do that again. That was kind of fun, and it's kind of nice having an outline. So taking Joseph, the story of Joseph, was kind of a natural thing for me. There are some obvious problems with this and some difficulties that made it challenging, and I think that's also made it a better book. One of which is we don't have pharaohs today. And we don't sell people off into slavery, just, you know, left and right. There's not people going around picking them up. And so how do you solve these problems? And so in my case, I just kind of flipped it and found a way to do it. And it made it fun, you know. And what his coat is, for instance, is, you know, what's a coat of many colors today Well, I think there's a clever solution to that.
You know, in the book, you mentioned the Technicolor coat. Now, one of my favorite plays is Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Yes. Have you ever seen that?
I have, and I know Donny Osmond, who did a fantastic job of it. Great story, and I'm sure that had something to do with, you know, with creating this book.
In The Winter Dream, or In a Winter Dream, you talk about an Osmond in here that you give thanks to for different things. I mean, it's in that part of the book where you're saying, hey, you know, thanks to my wife, thanks to my daughter, and thanks to my publicist and everybody else. I think it's Don Osmond.
Doug Osmond. Yeah.
Any relation to
Donnie? Oh, yes. He's Alan Osmond's son.
Really?
Yeah. He actually works for me. He does assemblies and promotions for some of my books. So he's one of the kids who was raised in Branson, the second generation Osmonds, fantastic singer. It's kind of fun because they'll break into song at any moment. All Osmonds can sing. They all have good teeth and they can all sing. And so it's fun having Doug around.
That's funny. Yeah. And when I saw that, I was wondering about that. So.
Oh, yeah. If it's an Osmond, they're related to Donnie and Murray, always. Yeah.
Cool. In A Winter Dream, how much research did you have to do, not only maybe on Denver? I mean, there's a great part in the book about the airport and the horse and kind of the history behind that.
My editor wanted me to cut that. She wanted me to cut it. I just came back and said no. I said, no, it's part of Denver. And what's funny is I'm getting all these letters from people in Denver saying, I didn't realize everyone thinks this way. It's a big demonic blue horse that terrifies people next to the airport. And the thing is, like, it's not only this terrifying horse statue. For those who haven't been to the Denver airport, it's this huge statue that was commissioned. It took years and years to put up. The people hate it. It's terrifying. People who are already afraid of flying or even, it's like, it's this omen. It has these blaring, these flaming red eyes that are terrifying. It's huge, but it also killed its maker. It's like Frankenstein. While he was working on it, the head fell off and crushed him and killed him. So it's like, this thing is truly possessed. And they put it out there, and there was this big petition to get it removed. And so anyway, people outside of Denver don't know about the blue horse. And so I put it in the book.
Well, they do now.
They do now, yes.
So they're still thinking about actually taking that down. It has to be up for like 5 years, I think you said.
Exactly. It has to be up for a certain while, and I don't know, maybe people get used to it, but yeah, I did a lot of research. Now I've been, I had a brother that lived in Colorado and in the Denver area, so I'm, you know, as close to Utah, I'm familiar with that part. What I needed to do though is go to Chicago, and specifically the Polish sections of Chicago. I had, when I was doing that research, I just got back from Poland and had this newfound love of pierogies and the Polish people. And so I came back to Chicago in their Polish district and rode the L. I was like, okay, I've got to get this guy's kind of his schedule down and routine. And it worked out extremely well. I was like, we found the right place. And but my favorite part outside of the deep dish pizza was the touring Leo Burnett. Because before I was a writer, I was in advertising. I was an advertising copywriter. And I studied the lives of the great advertisers, actually these men who created advertising. And Leo Burnett, if you don't know the name, you know what he's created. Pillsbury Doughboy, Marlboro Man, Tony the Tiger, Jolly Green Giant. He creates icons. He created these icons that we still recognize today. Well, that was one man who did it, who started this agency that now is this global billion-dollar agency. And so I knew about this agency and the people who had come out of, like, Claude Hopkins, one of the greatest copywriters of all time, which, you know, that's what I was doing when I was writing. And so we called them and they arranged a tour of Leo Burnett. So it was fun to walk through these hallowed halls. And it's like, this is so cool to be able to put this in the book.
Of course, in A Winter Dream, the protagonist, Joseph, he is an ad man, along with his 11 brothers, a couple sisters. I think there was like 13 kids in all, a huge family.
Right.
So there really is that advertising agency in Chicago.
Oh, yes.
With that name. Did you let them know that you were going to use that in your book?
Yes.
What did they think?
Well, they first asked if it was going to be used in a negative way, and I just laughed. I said no. I told them what I was doing, and they were remarkably receptive. They actually sent two executives down to meet me and walked me through and just gave me carte blanche to show me the main offices and answered all my questions and then gave me a nice gift pack when I was leaving. It's like, they were terrific. And I was really impressed. The thing is, I had always had this vision in my mind what it was like. And I wrote it before I went there. And I thought, I'll as a kind of a space keeper, but then I'll go and correct it when I get there and make changes. And I was pretty much dead on. The description of what the place looked like. I just had this vision of what it would be, and it didn't disappoint. It was better than I thought it would be, and it was really fun. And it's fun sharing that part. My editor wanted me to cut part of that too, and I said no. No, these are educational in a way. People want to, it's fun to read that. It's fun to know that there's one guy who created Tony the Tiger and the Jolly Green Giant. That he was a real man, and that why we have advertising, because that's what America is. It's one of the contributions to culture is we created advertising, and most of it started in Chicago. So to take this guy from a small ad firm in Colorado, and so when he's banished, we don't have any Ishmaelites to sell him off to. But he's hired by Timothy Ishmael. and he goes, he doesn't work for Potiphar, he works for Peter Potts. So there's these play on words that go on throughout.
Well, that had to be kind of fun to do, didn't it? And when you were writing that?
A lot of fun.
I mean, it just popped into your head? Or
Well, the nice thing about having a story that's already in the Bible, that you have certain an outline to a degree, because certain things have to happen. So the fun part is saying, okay, how do I get from here to there in a clever way? So I added some characters that obviously don't exist in the book, and they're really fun. People are really identifying. There's a guy named Leonard who is just funny. You hate him at first, and by the end, you just love the guy because he's so inept and he's so funny. You know where he's coming from. It's kind of like Michael Scott in The Office. You like hate him at first, and there's something endearing about him. In the end, you kind of like him a lot.
So. Richard, you'd mentioned you'd been to Poland, and of course, in Chicago, that's one of the biggest Polish communities anywhere outside of Warsaw, I guess.
Yeah, actually, I think there's more Poles in Chicago than there are in Warsaw.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, of course, you saw the sights, you smelled the smells in Poland. How well did you bring them to life in A Winter Dream?
Well, I probably pulled more from my experience in Poland than I did in Chicago, because I just had such a wonderful time in Poland. I got there and it's like, I'm kind of famous in Poland, which is really weird. I go there and there's big posters of me on the wall. It's like, oh, that's me. You know, all I can read is my name and nothing else. And
why is it?
I don't know. Well, actually, I asked the woman, I said, do you have a bestsellers list? She goes, well, yes. There's Eva was mine. I use her in the book. Eva, this fantastic media escort I had over there. And just a dear, dear woman. And I said, well, have I ever hit the bestseller list? And she just laughed for about a minute. It was the sweetest laugh. She goes, well, of course, Richard, you're very, very well known here. It's like, well, I don't know. You know, and I go to this hotel and it's like Notting Hill when all the press is lined up. And so I would sit there and they'd bring different people from the press to come in and interview me. And it's like, this is really cool. So, but I had some things we worked hard and there's things we had to do. It's like, we've got to eat pierogies. Because I'd heard of pierogies. Like, if you have a pierogi, you go to Poland to have a real pierogi. And I fell in love with pierogies. I gained like 5 pounds while I was there. It's great.
I think you kind of fry those up in butter sauce a little bit, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. We ate at this little Polish town called Dworzec, something like that. I just could not get that language down. We had this little town and they brought out the pierogies and it was like, they were in the traditional Polish garb. It was this tiny little place. It was so cute. And they brought the food out and three different kinds of sausage and the ones with like cabbage. And anyway, love the place.
And I'm going to kind of slide this book aside and bring out Michael Vay. I want to find out what Michael's about. Another favorite book of mine, Young Michael. And what would you call them, like this rogue group of kids? Although, you know, they have certain powers that nobody else has, but they were kind of bred that way.
The Electric Clan. Yes, the Electric Clan. Michael Vay is a story of Michael, who's a 15-year-old boy with Tourette syndrome and electrical powers. He's one of 17 electric children who were created on by accident. And each of their powers manifested in a different way. So that the Michael Vay series has been just a lot of fun.
They're still on the run.
Yeah.
All right, give me a little taste of book number two, which I've read.
Well, book number two, Rise of the Elgin, is it's a second book where you know the characters. They're going back to find Michael's mother, and they end up in South America. They end up in the jungles of the Amazon jungles of Peru. And I remember when I turned the book in, my editor said, or my publisher said, "You've been there before, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah, many times." He goes, "Yeah, you can tell, because I've been on that riverboat at least 5 times going up and down the Amazon, and or at least one of the tributaries of the Amazon." It was fun writing, because it's like taking these electric kids with their different kinds of powers and then throwing them in the jungle. As one guy said, "You're more dangerous than anything in the jungle. However, it's like, unless if you're struck by a viper, it's not going to do any good. So you might kill the viper, but you're going to die too." So interesting challenges they face. And the thing that was interesting, because the readers on Michael Vay are so broad. They go from 9 to 90, and I'm not exaggerating that. The first month out, I got at least 2 letters from people in their 90s who just love the book. And so I did see one Amazon review, and the reviews on the book are really good. You know, it's 4.7, and there's like almost 600 reviews. One woman wrote, "It's too scary. The second book was too scary because there's rats in the book." And it's like, okay, I put them on the cover, so you know there's rats in the book, and very special rats. And she goes, "How will this affect our kids?" Well, what we don't understand is that the kids aren't scared at all. We've been so desensitized. I was talking to a psychologist who is my father's age, and he said, "You have to understand how different the generations are. When I was little, the Three Stooges Meet the Mummy gave me nightmares. For us, it's a comedy. It doesn't affect us at all. My kids watch things that we have to stop them. It's like it's terrible to us." So the rats don't scare the kids so much, just a little. The thing was, I wasn't trying to create a dark book. I was trying to create something that would be suspenseful.
Ingenious, I thought.
So, there's also some really interesting kind of metaphors. At the end, when they go to feed Michael to rats, I was like, you know, not to be a spoiler alert, but if you think of the biblical story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, it's like it's a metaphor of that. Because all of a sudden, Hatch will never learn, you never put Michael by electricity. He likes it. It's like throwing the Brer Rabbit in the briar patch. It's like, don't do it. So that's his home.
Michael Vay, it's a fantastic series. If you haven't read it, I'd urge you to get that series, because I love it myself. The Walk. You're in about book number three of that?
I'm writing book number four right now.
Oh my gosh, tell me what's been happening.
Oh, that's crazy. The Walk series is probably a great way to get in my books, just because I have so many new readers from the Walk series. I think that's why, like when A Winter Dream came out, it debuted tied with number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list. My books are getting higher and higher on the list. I'm having books hit number 1 again, and it's because of all these new readers. And The Walk brought a lot of them in. The Walk is a story of Alan Christopherson, a man who, after losing his wife in a horrible accident, he's taking care of his wife before she dies. In the meantime, his partner steals his business, and he loses his home subsequently, and he's left with nothing. I wanted to explore loss. I want to explore how we deal with loss. When you've lost everything, why do you still live? That's really what The Walk is about. He decides first to take his life, and then he has an experience that he changes his mind, and he decides instead to just walk as far as he can from Seattle, where he is. He's also an ad man. I love writing about admin because that's my background. I think it's a really interesting field and people like to read about it. So he walks from Seattle to Key West, Florida. It's a series of 5 books. The first 3 books have all been New York Times bestsellers. They're spreading around the world. And that's why I went to Poland. They're just releasing the Walk series in Poland. But what's been fun to watch is just how many people, hundreds of thousands of people, are following this guy's walk. People think he's real. They follow his trail. Places he stops along the way, people now like flood to. So like some of the restaurants are getting really busy because of the Walk series. It's a lot of fun. In the 3rd book, he goes through Hannibal, Missouri, which was a lot of fun, staying there and researching. My assistant went back there and people were walking around carrying my book because he walks through Hannibal and they wanted to go see what was in Hannibal. And when the people at the Chamber of Commerce or Tourist Center saw her, when she told them who she was, she's like, "Oh my gosh, we love this guy. It's like he's helped our economy." But the deeper meaning of the walk is people follow this guy as they're finding meaning in their own lives. As a woman just wrote from Brazil, she said, "His story is all of our stories." And that is the point. He's learning these different lessons as he continues to progress across the country, as he meets interesting people. And we just keep, the book has not slowed down in terms of sales. It just sells every week, the same number of copies for the last 3 years, which is phenomenal. So everywhere I go in the country, it's like, what's going to happen? You know, give us a hint. Where is he going? You know, they want to know what's happening next. And in the end, of course, he ends up in Key West, Florida.
So this thing's so big. Do you think he'll walk maybe north and then across the top or something? I mean, you're going to keep it going, right?
No, I'm not. My publisher wants me to. They're really, publishers are funny because the first book came out, it's really large, much bigger than they thought it would be. It was on the Today Show. And so they said, we need to do 7 books. I go, I'm not doing 7 books. It's too many. I'm writing too many books. It's too hard. The next book came out and the sales were down. Well, that's kind of normal for a series. It's down there, like, maybe we need to cut the series. It's like, what? It sold a lot of books. It's still, it debuted at number 4 in the New York Times. I mean, it's still, it's, but, and then the third book came out and it rebounded completely. And so now it's growing. Now they're these solid people. We know from the letters we get a lot of mail. And the fact that I get as many men writing as women is very different for me. I've had three men, I think, so far in the Walk series who were like Alan. That they were considering taking their lives and contemplating. Some had made plans to take their lives. And the book just miraculously showed up in their lives, and they decided to postpone it. It's like, I want to see where this guy goes. And they've found hope in this guy's journey. And that was my hope. That was my hope, that people would read the book and be inspired by it and think. Because there's some dark things that happened to him. There's questions of revenge. What happens to these people? In the last book, he meets a survivor of the Holocaust. And I'm coming back from Poland. Now, I wrote this story about this man. He meets this guy who was a survivor from Sobibor. And I'm coming back from Poland, and there's all these Hasidic Jews up in first class on the flight. And this man's sitting next to me, and no one can talk to him, but people kept coming up to see him and talking to him. And finally, and I'd been helping him. He couldn't communicate with the flight attendant. I didn't think he spoke English. But suddenly, he turns to me as we're nearing America, and he goes, are you Polish? I said, no, I'm American. He said, why are you in Poland? And I told him, I'm an author. And he goes, oh. He goes, well, I have a story. And I hear that a lot. But it's like, do you? And he says, yes, I was in 7 concentration camps. He had gone back with all these Jews to walk through. He wanted to walk out of the camp on his own feet. And I said to him, have you ever heard of Sobibor? And his face turned gray. He goes, Sobibor. That is the worst of all. And he said, out of what, two or three million people that went through there, only 14 people survived. I mean, it was a death camp, not a holding camp. It was a death camp. It was designed to kill people as efficiently as possible. And he said, one of those people was my cousin. It turns out that his cousin is the guy I based the story on. He gave me the call. I didn't know the guy was alive. I did some research, found him. I thought, that is too strange. I meet this guy in Poland. And I said, I wrote about your cousin. He's in the book. So I thought it was an amazing little coincidence, if you will, that we were put together. The universe and the cosmos and God are just fantastic. I mean, it's just amazing how these things happen. So,
well, you know, if you've never read the Walk series, it's good because you've only got 1 book left to come out.
Two books left, yeah.
And every time I hear somebody that reads the book and they're waiting for that next year to roll around, they're just like pulling out their hair. Why? Why did he leave me here on the edge of my seat? What's going to happen? I mean, that's what I'm hearing.
Believe me, I hear that. We had with the second book, we had 12 people contact us who said they were dying, that several were on their deathbed. And they said, I just need to know who the woman he meets at the end of the book is, because it's a mystery. Who is she? Just tell me before I die. I just need to know. I thought, when you die, you'll know. not that I'm that crass or that hard. The problem is, we live in an age now where you make a comment and it can show up in the New York Times because everything's viral. Everything can be. And in fact, I made a comment in a small town at a book signing, and I got a call the next day from the president of Simon & Schuster International, who said, this is what I heard you said. I said, no, I didn't say that. It's just like, it spread that fast. You know, just there's nothing secret anymore. It's fascinating. So if I told one person, it's like the whole world will know who it is within 24 hours.
Wow. Well, A Winter Dream is your brand new book. Of course, Lost December, out right now in paperback, I'm sure. If I wanted to find out more about your Christmas books, The Walk, Michael Vay, and other writings you've done, you've got a website.
Yes, go to richardpaulevans.com. We have a nice website. You can look at the different books. Winter Dream is my 22nd New York Times bestseller. And you can just look at the books in the series. And I'm at this phase now where I kind of have something for everyone, men, women, and children. So, but all the books have been doing extremely well. And I'm very blessed to be able to do this.
And you've got a lot of followers on Facebook?
Yes. The Facebook page is fun. People respond. Altogether, I have about 75,000 people on Facebook that are following. So,
wow, that's pretty good. A Winner's Dream, of course, the brand new book by Richard Paul Evans. You know, by looking at this, I don't see anything on here that I should see, and it should be a warning about this book may cause restlessness at night if you don't finish it, because you'll want to just keep turning the pages. You'll want to get to the end of that story. You know, it could tug at the heartstrings, and a lot of these books really show you what love is. Richard, thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Been listening to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Richard Paul Evans, author of his brand new book, A Winter Dream. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.